Here's a question that'll get you kicked out of some engineering meetings. Is GraphQL actually a query language, or is it just a really opinionated HTTP API design with extra steps?
Oh, we're starting there. Okay, I love it. And honestly, it's a fair provocation because a lot of teams adopt GraphQL for the wrong reasons and then spend 6 months wishing they hadn't.
Exactly. So let's rip it apart properly today. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Emma. Welcome to Claude Talks. Today we're going deep on GraphQL, the spec, the execution model, schema design, the N+1 nightmare, data loader, subscriptions, federation, persisted queries, and the very uncomfortable question of when you should just use REST.
Let's start at the foundation. The GraphQL spec. Because I think a lot of engineers use GraphQL every day without actually knowing what the spec says. It's not just a Facebook idea, it's a published language specification.
Right. The spec defines three things primarily: the type system, the query language, and the execution semantics. The type system is where you define your schema, your types, fields, scalars, enums, interfaces, unions, input types. The query language is what clients send. And the execution semantics is the algorithm the server runs to produce a response.
And the execution semantics are actually really specific. The spec says you start from the root type, query, mutation, or subscription, and you resolve fields depth first, breadth first for parallel execution of sibling fields on the same object.
Technically, the spec says field execution on the same selection set is conceptually parallel, but mutations are explicitly serial. Each top-level mutation field must complete before the next one starts. That trips people up.
Yeah, mutations are sequential by the spec. Which makes sense, you're doing writes, ordering matters. But for queries, the server can resolve sibling fields in any order or in parallel. Most implementations do execute them in parallel where possible.
Let's talk about the execution algorithm concretely because it helps with debugging. Say you have this query, you ask for a user, their name, their posts, and for each post the title and author name. The execution starts at the query root, resolves the user field, gets back a user object. Then it takes that object and resolves name and posts in parallel. Posts returns a list. Then for each post object in that list, it resolves title and author in parallel. Author is another resolver call per post.
And that's where you start to feel the pain. Each author resolver is called once per post. So if you have 100 posts, you're calling the author resolver 100 times, each one potentially hitting the database.
The classic N+1 problem. One query for posts, N queries for authors. And it's not a GraphQL bug. It's a natural consequence of how field resolution works. Each resolver is independent. It only knows about its parent object.
Walk me through what the resolver signature looks like, because I want to make it concrete.
Sure. In a JavaScript implementation, let's say Apollo server, a resolver function receives four arguments: parent, args, context, and info. Parent is the resolved value of the parent field. So for the author resolver on a post type, parent is the post object. Args are the field arguments from the query. Context is your shared request context, database clients, auth info, that kind of thing. And info is the AST of the query, field selections, execution path, schema details.
So a naive author resolver might look like async function author of parent, args, context. Inside you do context.db.findUserById passing parent.authorID. Clean, readable, and absolutely lethal at scale.
Right. 100 posts means 100 separate database calls. Even if they're fast, that's 100 round trips. In production, that can mean hundreds of milliseconds of latency just from database fan out.
So data loader. This is the classic solution and it's genuinely elegant. Explain the batching mechanism.
Data loader works by coalescing individual load calls within a single event loop tick into a single batch request. Here's the flow. Your author resolver calls userLoader.load passing the author ID. Data loader doesn't immediately fetch. It schedules a micro task. Every other resolver in that same tick that calls userLoader.load also schedules. Then at the end of the tick, data loader collects all the unique IDs and calls your batch function once with an array of all IDs.
And the batch function is yours to implement. You query the database with a WHERE ID IN array of IDs, get back all the users, and return them in the same order as the input IDs. Data loader handles matching results back to the individual promises.
The ordering contract is important. Data loader requires that your batch function returns an array of the same length as the input keys array, in the same order. If a user isn't found, you return null or an error at that position. Break that contract and you'll get mysterious mismatches between data and resolvers.
And data loader also does per-request caching by default. If the same ID is loaded twice in one request, the second load gets the cached promise. Not cross-request caching, that would be a massive security issue, but within request deduplication.
Which means you should create a new data loader instance per request, typically in your context factory function. That's standard pattern in Apollo server. The context function runs per request, you instantiate fresh loaders there. They're scoped to that request lifecycle.
Okay, let's pivot to the schema itself, because schema design is where GraphQL really shines or really hurts you. What are the patterns you've seen work well?
A few strong patterns. First, represent your domain, not your database. Your GraphQL schema is a product API. It should reflect how clients think about your data, not how it's stored. If you have a users table and a profiles table that are always fetched together, they probably should be one type in your schema.
The classic impedance mismatch trap. You end up with a schema that's basically a thin veneer over your SQL tables, and then clients have to join things mentally that should have been joined for them.
Exactly. Second pattern, connection types for pagination. The relay connection spec is verbose, but it's worth it. Instead of returning a plain array for a list field, you return a connection object with edges, nodes, page info, and total count. Each edge has a cursor and a node. Page info has next page, has previous page, start cursor, end cursor.
Let me read the schema definition. Type user connection with fields edges as array of user edge and page info as page info. Type user edge with fields cursor as string and node as user. Type page info with has next page, has previous page as boolean, and start cursor, end cursor as nullable string.
It's more types, but it's stable. You can add metadata to edges, like a joined at timestamp on a user's friend's edge. And cursor-based pagination handles real-time data additions better than offset pagination.
What about interfaces and unions? I see a lot of schemas that underuse these.
Hugely underused. Interfaces let you say multiple types share a common set of fields. Classic example. You have a feed that can contain posts, images, videos. You define a feed item interface with fields like ID, created at, author. Then post, image, video all implement that interface. Your feed query returns a list of feed item.
And on the query side, clients use inline fragments to select type-specific fields. Three dots on post select title and body. Three dots on video select thumbnail URL and duration. The underscore underscore type name field is automatically available and lets clients branch their rendering logic.
Unions are similar but without the shared fields contract. Use unions when the types genuinely share nothing structurally. A search result union might be user or post or article. They don't share fields, but they can all appear in search results.
Let's talk subscriptions, because this is where GraphQL gets genuinely interesting and also genuinely complicated.
Subscriptions are the third operation type in the spec. Instead of the request response model of queries and mutations, subscriptions are long-lived operations where the server pushes events to the client. The transport is typically WebSockets, though GraphQL over server-sent events is also possible.
The execution model is different. When a client subscribes, the server registers the subscription and returns an event stream. Each event triggers the subscription resolver, which produces a GraphQL result, a full query execution against that event payload.
So let's say you have a subscription on MessageAdded that takes a channel ID argument. When a new message is created, the subscription system publishes an event to the channel topic. All subscribers to that channel receive the event, their subscription resolver runs against the new message object, and they get back exactly the fields they selected.
The implementation typically uses a PubSub system. Apollo has its own in-memory PubSub, but it explicitly says that's only for development. For production, you need Redis PubSub or a message broker like Kafka, because your GraphQL servers are horizontally scaled, you can't rely on in-memory state.
The subscription resolver pattern has two parts. Subscribe returns an async iterator. It's an async iterator over events. And resolve optionally transforms each event before field execution. The async iterator is the bridge between your PubSub system and the GraphQL execution engine.
And there are real operational concerns. WebSocket connections are stateful. Each connected client holds a connection on your server. 100,000 concurrent subscribers means 100,000 open WebSocket connections. You need to plan for connection limits, heartbeats, reconnect ION logic on the client side.
Also, authentication. HTTP requests have headers. You check a JWT on every request. WebSockets establish the connection once. So your auth token goes in the connection_init message of the GraphQL WS protocol. You validate it at connection time and store the user in the connection context. But then you need to handle token expiry gracefully. Either reconnect or refresh within the protocol.
Let's move to federation. Because this is where GraphQL scales organizationally, not just technically.
Federation is Apollo's answer to the microservices problem. You have multiple teams, each owning a service and a schema. How do you give clients a unified API without one giant monolithic schema or constant cross-team coordination?
The federation model is each service defines a subgraph. A subgraph is a valid GraphQL schema with some federation-specific directives. The gateway, Apollo Router or Apollo Gateway, introspects all the subgraphs and composes them into a supergraph. Clients query the supergraph, the gateway figures out which subgraphs to query and how to combine the results.
The key federation directive is @key. This tells federation which field or fields uniquely identify an entity. So in the user service, you define the user type with @key of ID. That means user can be referenced and extended by other services.
In the product service, you might have a review type. A review has an author field that's a user. The product service doesn't own user, it just declares a stub, type user with @key of ID is @external, and it has one field ID which is also @external. Then the author resolver returns just the user ID, and the gateway knows it needs to fetch the rest of user from the user service.
This is the entity resolution pattern. The gateway performs what's called an entity fetch. It calls the user services _entities query with a list of representations, each representation being the key fields, just the ID in this case. The user service resolves each representation to a full user object.
So from the client's perspective, they get one seamless query. Under the hood, the gateway is doing a query plan, figure out which subgraphs to hit, in what order, what data to pass between them. The query plan is deterministic and can be inspected for debugging.
Schema composition is where it gets complex. If two subgraphs define the same type, they need to agree on shared fields. Federation has rules about value type sharing versus entity extension. You can share simple value types freely. Entities are owned by one service and extended by others.
And in Federation 2, they introduced the @shareable directive, which allows the same field to be resolved by multiple subgraphs. That's useful for data that genuinely lives in multiple places but is authoritative across all of them.
Let's talk about caching, because this is one of the hardest problems in GraphQL, and it's often why teams get frustrated.
REST is cacheable by default. A /users/123 is a cache key. HTTP caches, CDNs, browsers, they all understand this. GraphQL queries are typically post requests to a single endpoint with a body. CDNs don't cache post bodies. You lose the entire HTTP caching layer.
There are a few approaches. First, GET requests for queries. The GraphQL spec allows queries over GET. You encode the query and variables as URL parameters. Then CDNs and browsers can cache the response.
Second approach, persisted queries. This is the most production-ready solution. Instead of sending the full query string every request, you pre-register queries on the server and send a hash. The client sends the hash, the server looks up the query by hash and executes it.
The flow. During your build process, you extract all your client queries, hash them, and upload the hash to query map to your server or CDN. At runtime, the client sends operation name and a hash. The server fetches the query text from the map, executes it. CDNs can cache based on the hash. It's a stable identifier.
Apollo calls this automatic persisted queries, or APQ. There's also the stricter version, sometimes called trusted documents or safe listing, where only pre-registered queries are allowed at all. This is a security win too. Clients can't craft arbitrary queries against your server.
The safe listing approach is great for first-party clients where you control the consumers. It eliminates whole classes of query complexity attacks. A client can't send a deeply nested query designed to do O of N cubed work on your server.
Query complexity is a real concern. Because GraphQL is so expressive, a malicious or just careless client can construct queries that are exponentially expensive. You need depth limiting and complexity scoring in your schema execution layer.
Complexity scoring assigns a cost to each field and type. Lists are expensive because they multiply costs. A field that returns a list of users, each with their own list of posts, each with their own list of comments, the complexity compounds. You calculate the total cost before execution and reject the query if it exceeds a threshold.
Libraries like GraphQL Query Complexity let you define per field costs with multipliers for list fields based on the limit argument. It's not perfect, you're estimating, not actually measuring, but it's a practical defense.
Third caching approach. Response caching with cache hints. Apollo supports at cache control directives on fields, and their response cache plugin caches full query responses in Redis or Memcached. The cache TTL for a response is the minimum TTL of all at cache control hints across all resolved fields.
So if your user type has a max age of 300 seconds but the current user field has max age of 0, because it's user-specific, the whole response is uncacheable. Your cache design has to be careful about what fields you mark as cacheable.
And there's the field-level caching layer from Apollo Server, the data source caching, where individual field responses can be cached and reused within a request or across requests. It's a layered caching strategy. Data loader for within-request batching and deduplication, field cache for short-term cross-request caching, full response cache for read-heavy queries.
Okay. Let's talk about when not to use GraphQL. Because this is the part people skip.
The honest answer is GraphQL is not the right tool for every problem. The cases where I'd push back on adoption. Simple CRUD APIs with well-defined resources and few relationships. If your API is basically five tables and clients always want the full row, REST is simpler, faster to build, and the HTTP caching story is much better.
GraphQL's power comes from relationships and flexible field selection. If your data is flat and clients' needs are predictable, you're paying all the GraphQL overhead, schema definition, resolver boilerplate, query complexity concerns, without getting the benefits.
File uploads are awkward. The GraphQL multipart request spec exists, but it's non-standard and many frameworks handle it badly. Most teams I've seen just expose a REST endpoint for uploads and reference the uploaded file by URL or ID in GraphQL mutations.
Real-time streaming of large payloads. Subscriptions work well for discrete events, a new message, a state change, a notification. If you're streaming binary data, large files, or continuous sensor data, WebSockets with a custom protocol or even SSE is cleaner than GraphQL subscriptions.
Public APIs with third-party consumers who you don't control. Introspection means anyone can explore your entire schema. Query complexity attacks become a real surface area. For public APIs, I'd often reach for REST with OpenAPI because it's more universally understood. Tooling is better for code generation across languages, and the operational concerns are simpler.
And internal tool APIs where speed of development matters more than elegance. If two backend services are talking to each other, gRPC or plain REST is probably faster to ship than setting up a GraphQL schema and resolvers.
The GraphQL sweet spot is a product API serving multiple first-party clients, web, mobile, maybe a third-party integration layer, where those clients have divergent data needs, where the data model is graph-shaped with meaningful relationships, and where you have the engineering maturity to manage schema evolution, query complexity, and the operational pieces.
Schema evolution is worth unpacking. One of GraphQL's promises is that you can evolve schemas without breaking clients. And that's largely true. Adding fields is non-breaking, adding types is non-breaking, adding optional arguments is non-breaking. But removing or renaming fields is breaking.
The deprecation workflow. You add the @deprecated directive with a reason to the field you want to remove. Clients get warned. You monitor usage. Apollo Studio and similar tools track field usage by query. Once usage drops to zero, or after a sunset date you've communicated, you remove the field.
The risk is you never know if someone has a hard-coded client somewhere that's still using a deprecated field. Usage analytics are your safety net. If you see zero usage for 3 months and then you remove a field and get a bug report, that client wasn't showing up in your analytics, worth investigating.
Versioning strategy. The GraphQL community generally discourages API versioning in the sense of /v1/v2. Instead, you evolve the schema continuously with deprecations. But some teams run multiple schema versions through federation, a v1 supergraph and a v2 supergraph side by side. Heavy machinery, but sometimes necessary for large backward compatibility windows.
Let's close with some hard-won operational wisdom. What do you wish you knew before running GraphQL at scale?
Number 1. Instrument everything. You need per-resolver latency and error rates. The query is a tree, you need to know which leaf is slow. Apollo Tracing, OpenTelemetry GraphQL instrumentation. Pick something and use it from day 1.
Number 2. Normalize your query documents before hashing or logging. Two clients can send the same logical query with different white space, different field ordering, different variable names. Normalize the AST before any comparison or storage, otherwise your analytics are noisy.
Number 3. The introspection endpoint is a double-edged sword. Enable it in development, disable it in production for public-facing services. If you need it in production for internal tooling, put it behind auth.
Number 4. Schema linting and breaking change detection in CI. Tools like GraphQL Inspector or Rover for Apollo Federation will catch breaking changes, removed fields, changed argument types, removed types, before they hit production. This should be a required CI check.
And number 5. Understand the query plan before you ship a feature. Federation's query planner can sometimes produce surprising plans, fetching from 3 subgraphs when you expected 2. Use Apollo Sandbox or the Rover CLI to inspect the query plan during development. Surprises in production are expensive.
GraphQL is genuinely powerful when you understand what it's doing under the hood. The execution model, the N+1 patterns, the caching story, once you internalize those, you can design schemas and resolvers that are fast, maintainable, and safe.
And when you catch yourself fighting the framework, when every query is becoming a performance investigation, when the schema is becoming a mirror of your database, when clients are not actually benefiting from the flexibility, take a step back and ask whether REST would have been simpler here.
Pragmatism over dogma. That's the senior engineer play.
Always. Thanks for going deep with us today. If you're building with GraphQL and want to dig into any of these topics, data loader patterns, federation architecture, persisted query infrastructure, we'd love to hear what problems you're running into.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Emma. This is Claude Talks. See you next time.